Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 25th, 2001. In the Koinonia Creekside room this afternoon is Christy Traina. Today's session number is TRC 2001-03, and it's titled Sister Bear, Brother Mosquito, Thinking About Animals. Let's listen in.
So is ethics taught in the philosophy department?
Yes, in the philosophy department as well. Mm-hmm. Well, I have a course in Christian ethics in which we have to do three or four topics, mm-hmm. depending on what I feel like doing that year. Well, people might drift in, but we probably should get started. The beginning of what I have to say doesn't really need to go on the tape. That's for the invisible people in the media center. First of all, you're invited to pick up assisted listening devices in the media center if you find that I'm not loud enough or my voice is at the wrong pitch for you to hear. Please feel free to dash out and get one of those. I won't be offended. Another thing to know is that all the sessions are available on tape. So if you have missed a session while you're here that you'd like to hear, you're welcome to go and pick it up out of the listening library and hear it, or you're welcome to purchase a tape in the bookstore and take it home with you. You might also want to know that all of the folks who are teaching here have recommended particular books for purchase. There are a couple that I have asked to be put in the bookstore that you might be interested in if you're interested in ecological issues. One of them is called State of the World 2001. It's an annual volume and it has short essays on various topics. Every year they're slightly different. Some of them are on the state of the water supply. Some of them are on the state of sustainable agriculture. Some of them are on petroleum or sustainable transportation. Every year there's a different selection, but if you keep up with those, you'll be really well informed about the state of world ecology. The other book that has to do with ecology that I've asked to have put in there is a book compiled by Michael Schutt, who will actually be here later this summer, and if you have an opportunity to come back while he's here, I encourage you to do that. But it's a collection of writings on lifestyle, and lifestyle we're used to thinking of as our personal private choices that make us happier or sadder. This is not that kind of book. It's about lifestyle, but it's about our spirituality, our attitude toward our life, and the kind of effect that the life that we choose has on the people and the landscape around us. And so it's tying the way we live not to just what makes us feel happier and simpler, but to the way in which it affects the world and how we can reduce that impact or make that impact positive through the little choices we make in our daily lives.
Would you spell his last name?
S-C-H-U-T. It's called Simple Living, Compassionate Life. And the other thing that's great about it is that you can take it home and use it for a book discussion group in your congregation, because it's beautifully set up at the end with suggestions for using it for adult education circles. It's a great read, sort of a chapter a night thing to meditate on. But it's also a wonderful resource to take home and use in your congregation if you want to raise people's consciousnesses about spirituality, ecology, and ethics. There's a third one that's there that I asked to have bought, which has nothing to do with either thing. I'll just describe it really briefly, especially those of you who've been going to Steve Gramsci's sessions might want to read it. It's a book by Michael Salzman called Lying Awake, about a Cistercian nun in Los Angeles who has a brain tumor and who also has very exceptional creative abilities in writing, in spiritual writing. Like many other gifted spiritual writers in Christian history, actually, who had epilepsy or other brain problems. And it's about the intersection between science and spirituality, and about the intersection between what seems to be completely irrelevant traditional spiritualities and contemporary culture, and it raises lots of interesting questions sensitively without answering them. But it's a very friendly not hard-hitting read and a great sort of book to read while you're in a place like Holden. So that's there where you're used to. Okay. We can probably start taping now. I'm Christy Trainer. I'm teaching a series on religion and ecology. And today's topic is how to think of animals within our Christian framework and within an ecological framework. What kinds of beings are animals? How do we relate to them? What do we think about them? Okay. And just as a way of getting us started, I'd like you to fill out a piece of paper with three columns, and I'll title them on the board. And while we're doing this, tape people, you might want to turn the tape off, but let me announce the columns first, okay? The first column I'd like you to write, animals you've cared for. Next column is, this is basically broad species. You don't have to go down to the detail of individual sort of animal necessarily. The next one would be animals you killed. Next one is animals you've eaten. Okay? Think about those for a few minutes and see what you come up with.
Can you say cared for? Are you physically or
physically? Physically.
That we not ourselves have.
Yeah, you not have cared for. Like, right, not just ones you care about.
Right.
Okay. But ones you've cared for, taking care of.
And then animals we've killed, accidentally or on purpose.
Yeah.
Either way.
Either way. Mostly on purpose, I'm thinking.
Okay.
Okay, so take folks, you can turn it off for a couple minutes if you want to stay safe. Thank you. begin to run dry. Got pretty completeness. Okay.
Yes, you
want to
tape again?
Okay. Yes, we do. Okay, tape people, turn on the tape. We've all done lists, and we're going to do a bit of reflecting on everyone's list, but let's just take one list as an example. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting your name.
Sure.
Okay, Tara, could you give us your...
Which, the animal's barefoot?
Yeah,
the
whole thing.
Okay, dogs and cats.
Okay.
Birds, turtles, salamanders, gerbils, fish, frogs, did I put snakes down?
Okay, I think we need to go to another one. Okay.
That's it anyway.
All right. How about animals you've done in?
I've killed?
Mm-hmm.
Goldfish, that was really sad. A fish. And I'm not sure if I killed those when my kids killed those. And bugs.
Okay.
And then I hit a deer with my car too, as well as a goldfinch. And butterflies. I hit them with the car too.
Yeah, we're not sure what we've hit. What quite has ended up on the windshields of our cars, unless it's a lightning bug, you really can't tell, right? Okay. And how about eating?
Okay. Fish. Lamb, beef,
okay,
chicken, deer, and pork.
Okay. Those are your only animals you eat?
I think so.
Okay. All right, on all of your diagrams, you'll probably find places where you can connect across two or three different categories. Here you've got a couple of them, right? Some of you might have more than one place you can connect all three, especially if you've ever lived on a farm. Anybody lived on a farm here? Okay, darn, it's always good to have farmers in the group. It's really effective because they just cover the whole thing, you know? So what do you think about, what kinds of lines have you got across on your list? Any?
Frog.
Goes all the way across, okay.
I don't have any. I have chicken. I've cared for chickens, but I've also eaten them.
Okay.
I didn't kill them, thank God.
Okay.
Geese, same thing.
Okay.
Rabbit, same thing.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, I've had those too, but I haven't eaten rabbit.
Fish,
okay.
All kinds of fish, but I haven't ever cared for them, but I've killed a lot of trout and bass.
Uh-huh. And dogs. Their guts out.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. One of the interesting things about our urban and prepackaged life today is that very few of us actually draw lines all the way across. Now, what happens, those of you who have drawn lines all the way across, I mean, is there just one way of, how do you think of these animals in each of these situations? Who are they? Or what are they?
One really thing I think is really interesting is how the ones that we often eat, we have a different word for them when we eat them.
Yeah.
And I was thinking of that when I was trying to figure out, how do I write down beef? I mean, when you look at an animal, you don't say that's beef. I'm thinking, well, that's cattle, but then when I write it down here, it's beef.
Or
veal. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Or pork.
Pork, yes, exactly.
Right.
Unless you call it a pork, it's a pig.
Yeah.
Right, or a hog.
Right.
Carol J. Adams has written some very interesting work, and I was limited in the books that I could bring because I was flying on an airplane, so I didn't bring her work, but she's written some very interesting things. And one of her important observations is we try to call it something else. And all of you who've raised children have probably gotten to the point with some child when they say, chicken, chicken, oh, right? And for a few days they won't eat it after that, right? I don't know if that ever happens to any of you. It happens at our house with each kid growing up, you know? And we objectify, make ourselves more comfortable with the flesh by calling it something else. It becomes meat. It is not an animal, right? But it is meat. It is something we eat, and when we buy it, it's dissected already for us, so that we don't have to look at it as an animal to care for. How about those of you, though, who have done all three to something? Do you look at that differently in the different stages?
Yes. Well, I've got that. I had chickens when I was little, because then, you know, they gave them and for Easter, which they keep discouraged now, which is a good thing. But when the chicken grew up, my grandma took that chicken and slaughtered it and prepared it for dinner. And my sister and I could not eat that chicken because we had nurtured and loved that chicken. And it was just horrifying for us to eat something that we had loved. And people, I knew a really good friend that lived on a farm. She never had that feeling about any of her animals. She never really loved and got attached to them like we in the city do.
Mm-hmm. Or if they do, there's a certain distancing, yeah. Right?
Because they know it's being raised only for food. You know, it's not a pet.
Right. But that conflict comes up in the children's book, Charlotte's Web, right?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, gosh, this pig can't go with the other piglets because I've taken care of it, and it's my pet now. It's not food. It's a person, right? And that happens. And so very often we have to make this division between a pet, a companion to us, and something that is food for us. Right? And we can't really put those two in the same category. Most of us don't eat our dogs after we put them to sleep, right? Or in Carol Adams' book, one of her great examples is a favorite horse on her parents' land that she has ridden. And she goes back to a visit to her parents, and I think it's the day that she arrives. I'm probably going to get this wrong because I don't have a book with me. The day that she arrives, the horse breaks its leg, has to be shot, and is carried away to be made into dog food or something. And then her parents prepare hamburgers that night for dinner, and she just can't eat it because she's thinking of her pet, which has been transformed into slaughterhouse material. Right.
We had no ruling in, I grew up in Maine, and South Portland, where there may be now, but at that time there weren't any strict rules about what you could have around. My dad raised chickens, we had a chicken house up there.
Mm-hmm.
And they did rabbits, and I don't remember for what, and we didn't raise pets out of it. But one time we were eating, and I asked my mother what it was, she said fricassee. She always made a chicken fricassee. It turned out that it was not a chicken, it was a rabbit fricassee, and my brothers and I wouldn't touch it. No way were we going to eat that fricassee. But we could eat the chicken. I don't know now if it's still good enough at that time. Mm-hmm. And veal, someone had told me how they raise veal, they tie it to a station and they are hardly able to move at all, and mm-hmm. It's very young critters, and they're just raised for killing. That, I can't eat veal anymore.
So there was a divide in your head somewhere between mm-hmm. the rabbits who were pets and cute, fluffy, and cuddly, and the chickens who were food, right? I'm not saying that it's wrong to make that division. We have to make that division, but we have to be careful about how we do it, because are we doing it just based on our sentiments, or is there some other rationale by which we divide these things from each other? Unless we are going to be vegetarians and also not slap mosquitoes and kill the wasp and get rid of wasp nests, right?
Mm-hmm.
We need to figure out some way of thinking about animals in relation to us. Yes.
I've lived on an Indian reservation the last 20 years, and I've gotten a lot of insights, but one of the ones that has influenced my life the most, I think, is how in the traditional way they think of this, which is because they go out and kill elk and salmon, or the way they, you know, that's their main mm-hmm. staple and so forth, and they think of it as everything has a life and everything has a death, and we're all in a cycle, and we all help sustain the planet after our death. And that when you have to kill an animal, you only kill it for if you really need to eat it. You don't kill it just for sport. And then when you do, just before you kill it, you say a prayer thanking it, that animal, for giving its life for you. And then each season, there at the beginning of the season, like there's the first deer and the first salmon, and also they do the same for huckleberries and and those kind of things. And there's a ceremony where only people that have had a special, that or the elders can go out and kill the first one of the season and then bring it in, and then they have a big ceremony thanking God, the Creator, for giving us this food and thanking that animal. And that kind of as a way of thinking of that animal, like when if I you know, catch a fish to eat, that, I mean, it makes a difference to me. I used to really hate, my sister, okay, you kill it, and then I'll cook it, but I don't want to kill it. But, you know, thinking of it in that kind of a balanced way has made a big difference to me.
It's an attitude of gratitude,
exactly,
right, toward a being which is sustaining you.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
So it's not so much an objectification. I'll eat it, but I really don't want to see it before it's cut up.
Right.
I don't want to think about the fact that I'm eating a cow or whatever it is that I'm eating. I think I'm very mindful, right, of what I'm eating. And whenever we're mindful of something, we also tend to be more sparing of it or more appreciative of it. So those are, that attitude is something that assists us, I think, in having a healthy attitude to what we're doing. One of the big questions when it comes to not just personal eating, but ecology, is how do we consider animals? And for what reason do we consider them? Okay. It's just like inclusivity or generosity or anything else. We all agree the virtue of respect for animals. But the question is, the hard question, the brass tacks question, is how do we go about that, right? How do we make decisions? How do we make those tough decisions? And that's really where the rubber hits the road, and that's where I'm thinking of our going today, because it's fine to be prophetic. It's wonderful, in fact. And I'll pass around some pictures from prophetic books about animals. Okay? But being prophetic is not enough. We have to figure out how to behave. Okay? So we need the prophet. Don't get me wrong. We have to have the prophet. But we also need people who are willing to do the hard thinking, sit down and figure out how to go about being with animals. Okay? I'm going to do a little bit of recapping right now for those of you who might not have been in earlier sessions, but that might help us think about this a little bit, basic principles or assumptions that help us operate some. One of them is that we need to overcome something which in very fancy language is called, by eco-theologians, hierarchical dualism. Those of you who study Eastern thought might be familiar with this symbol, yin and yang. This is supposed to be all green, but I don't have time to color it in. It's dark and light, right? There are two in every case, there are two kind of forces or tendencies in opposition, each of which contains a little seed of the other, right? Well, in Western Greek and Roman thought, things have tended to get organized a little differently. These are equal, they're interdependent, right? Sort of chasing each other. In the West, we've tended to organize things differently. We have oppositions of the same sort, lightness and darkness, goodness and evil, spirit and matter, etc. But we tend to organize them not in equal pairs, but in unequal pairs. We put one above the other. So instead of having spirit and matter sort of in tension and cooperation this way, we'll put spirit above matter and good the evil and thoughts about cold, men about women, and in this case, humanity about animals. We can just go, you can go on and on and on this way. You can make a list with probably 20 pairs that you can think of from contemporary culture in which there's a one-up, one-down relationship. And these things are so, in some sense, interdependent in tension with each other, but one is definitely considered to be better than the other. Okay? And we have then humanity above animals, spirit above matter. Humanity above animals because humans are more rational, more spiritual and souled, and animals are not considered to be so.
You always have to have a minimum as a top priority.
Well, traditionally, this is sort of a structure we have to overcome if we're going to be able to think ecologically, right? In other words, this is a problem to solve if we're going to think ecologically. The other thing we need to realize is that according to contemporary Christian eco-theologians, sometimes when we read the Bible, we're looking for a kind of a golden age. Let's look at how they did it in the early church and let's be like them because then we'll be real Christians. There's some period in history where they did it right and we're going to go back and find that. This isn't really true in eco-theology. There's no place in the Christian scriptures where you can go back and say, oh, they had it. Let's use that. Okay? So this is important to be aware of. There are a few, let me just outline a few things we can find in scripture. I'm not going to go into them in great detail, but if you're interested, you can kind of look them up and make use of them. A few interesting things on scripture on animals. First of all, there was no eating of flesh before the fall. When Adam and Eve were put into the Garden of Eden in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, they had permission to eat of all the plants, but not of the animals. Permission to eat animals doesn't come until the Noahic covenant. God puts the rainbow in the sky, says, I promise never to destroy the earth with water again. By the way, you can eat the animals too. Okay? So that's interesting to know. What to do about it, I don't know, but there it is. Then the Sabbath rest also includes animals. Not only are you not to work your servants and your family and yourself, but you are to give your oxen a day off. Okay. And that implies then inclusion of animals in that. The sacrifice of animals is enjoined. Now, that can go either way, but it suggests that the animals are gifts of God and valuable, right? They're not worthless. Otherwise, there wouldn't be much of a point in sacrificing them to God, right? And there are sacrifices of thanksgiving and expiation. So that indicates the valuableness of animals. Also, in Isaiah 11, 6 through 9, when it talks about the new heaven and the new earth, the lion shall lie down with the lamb, etc., that's very interesting because when you look at those passages, what those depict are peace between wild animals and domestic animals, threatening animals out there in the wild and human society and its animals that domesticates and raises. So that may be an indication almost more of friendship between culture and wildness as it is an indication of friendship among animals and no eating going on. So that's ambiguous but interesting. Then you have the disciples fishing, of course, so that implies that it may not be a bad thing. Okay, but those are biblical references about how to treat animals or not. It's kind of like looking through the Bible for indications on homosexuality and some other issues that we're trying to deal with today, like international debt, right? The Bible has a few things to say, but nothing very direct, and what we need to do is go to the Bible for principles. There are two basic approaches that theologians have taken on animals recently. And so here I'm going to be kind of laying out the possibilities for you more than, I may be tipping my hand a little bit to which ones I think are more important than others, but just to give you a sense of what's out there, because respect for animals can go in a lot of different directions. One of them is animal rights. And when you mention, for instance, the treatment of veal calves, right, this is one of the things that comes up. Peter Singer is not Christian, but his work is used very heavily by Christian thinkers on animal rights. And if you've ever read Animal Liberation, you may know of some of what he does. He has a number of pictures in here of the way that animals are raised or used in experiments, and the amount of space that's considered appropriate for a chicken and a laying hen in a cage. Have you ever been in a laying hen house? Okay. Well, tell me about it.
Well, they manipulate the lights to make them lay more. There are these tiny things, and they cut their beaks off.
So so they won't injure each other.
Yeah. They're just boxed, and they're in stacks. And
in tiers, And they're in wire bottom cages so that the eggs will drop out onto the conveyor belts. And you have three birds in a cage that might be, I don't know, 14 inches by 2 feet, 2.5 feet, something like that. Okay. And so you have to go through occasionally and pull out the dead ones, right? And the stench, by the way, is overwhelming.
And don't they don't give them much water, right? So their dung is able to be actually blown out rather than...
I think you're right. Yeah. I think you're right. This has pictures of laying hens in cages, and our relatives who raise chickens still do it this way, so it's not, when you buy free-range hen eggs, you can understand the difference now if you have the option in your grocery store. So here are some pictures, anyway, from Peter Singer on the treatment of animals, of livestock. And there are some other ones in here. This is also another book that goes into animal rights and complains about the treatment of animals being raised for food in our country.
Is he a vegetarian?
Peter Singer?
He's
fit. I think so. The animal rights argument, as I mentioned with Carol Adams, is a very, very prevalent one. It's what drives your local humane society. It's what drives your local horse rescue people. Okay? It's what drives people who are concerned about the treatment of animals in zoos. It's what drives people who buy mouse traps that don't kill the mice. Although the effectiveness of such mouse traps is questionable because the mice come right back in the house. Anyway.
Right, you take them farther away.
Right. That takes some effort, though.
I catch them in the basement, bring them up into the bathtub. And they seem to know that the mouse can't get out of the bathtub. We had this going on for a couple months last winter. Someone said, you probably got the same mouse every day or every night. I should mark it with nail polish. Someone, a cousin working on a farm, said a farm animal, a farm cat, would kill a mouse, but house animals won't. And they didn't. Free cast it.
They have to learn.
And I put it in a plastic bag and took it out, put it out the edge of our property. But it was, maybe it was staying on, but this went on for several weeks. And it was the jangling of the cat's tag against the bathtub. It would wake me up and I thought, oh, here we go again. Here's the mice here, so.
So they're good at catching them, at least. So you have humane cats.
I do. And I'm humane with them. I wouldn't hurt them.
The question is then, the question for animal rights activists is, how do we prevent the mistreatment of animals, and how do we advance the fulfillment of their lives and reduce their suffering?
And that's based on a prior assumption that they feel the same way that we do, or that they feel in some way that we can kind of extrapolate that they are suffering as we would suffer if we were three in a cage that size.
That's true. It's making particular assumptions. How have you ever read an animal rights article that's, for instance, suggested that it was a bad idea to swat mosquitoes?
Nope.
Okay.
Except for Indians.
Have you ever read an animal rights article that suggested that it was a bad idea to let a copperhead make its way through a campsite. No. Okay. What is it in an animal rights viewpoint that qualifies an animal as worthy of our attention, as demanding something from us? What qualifies an animal as demanding something from us? That as needing to be taken care of by us, as needing to be respected, not cause pain, not confined, so that only it can only open one wing but not the other wing.
Well, animals that aren't harmful to us, that don't spread and carry diseases to us.
Okay. So animals that aren't harmful.
Don't they tend to be ones that are in our care.
Right, animals that are in our care. Although people don't tend to like to see deer dragged down by wolves, right? They're usually warm-blooded, right? Cuddly in some way or cute, right?
A lot of people like snakes, though.
Yeah, snakes, whales, and dolphins, yeah. But they are mammals, right?
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing about animal rights advocates is that they tend to go for the more sentient, more human-like animals. Either animals that are under our care or animals that are in some way cute, warm, or cuddly. Okay. And the question is, what then makes those animals more worthy of our attention inherently than a mosquito, a toad,
a slug,
exactly. Something, an aphid, something you don't want in your garden, right? What is it that makes one sort of animal inherently more worthy of our attention than others? Are the animals closer to us on the evolutionary chain more worthy of our attention and the animals farther away less worthy?
They shouldn't be, because by encouraging one over the other, we're upsetting the balance.
That's right, and it gets us in. That gets us into a really important place we wanted to go next, so thank you for taking us there. Okay. There are a few places in Christian history, by the way, where animals are respected as themselves. St. Francis of Assisi is a great illustration of that. We could talk more about him. But usually, when we talk about animal rights, we're talking about sentience, the ability to feel and demonstrate that we can feel physically, right, pain, or rationality. You know, animals that can talk, we like. Right, animals that can talk to each other. But we can only go so far with animal rights per se, because we can never get to the point where we can say, well, we respect all animals equally as beings with a right to exist. One of the reasons we can't do that is that the existence of some animals depends upon the deaths of others. Anything carnivorous needs to eat the flesh of another animal. And it's pretty impossible, therefore, to completely protect animals from us and from each other, right? We can't do it. And so the animal rights language, in my opinion, this is where my colors go, okay, can't take us all the way, okay? It's important, yes, not to torture animals for the sake of pleasing ourselves, right? It's important not to raise them in ways which are causing them great pain, but we can't go all, that doesn't get us where we need to go completely. So there's another point of view which is really more ecosystematic in the way that Char has mentioned, and that's really species preservation. And that's kind of an umbrella which is approximately descriptive for a number of approaches. Okay. One of them is aesthetic. How many of you read Rachel Carson's Science Spring at some point in life? Okay. This is certainly not her entire argument, but one of the things that gets her going is suddenly noticing the disappearance of the songbirds. The world is not as pretty a place without their music and their bright feathers. Okay. We lose something aesthetically when we lose a species or lose the members of that species from our neighborhood. Okay. Another one is ecosystematic preservation. The reason the songbirds disappear in Silent Spring is that the bugs they used to eat and have all been killed by pesticides, and therefore either the birds eat the sick bugs and die from the poisons, or they find there's no food and they go elsewhere. Okay. Both of those happen. Okay. So that's one option. Another one is plain and simple biodiversity. Biodiversity is the argument that we need to preserve as many species of plants and animals as possible, because the moment that any of them disappears, our genetic stock is reduced and our world becomes less flexible, less able to respond to climate change. We have fewer materials with which to work with agriculture, and therefore we need to preserve diversity. Now, the interesting thing about species preservation points of view, which, again, that's only a very rough umbrella, it doesn't really precisely describe what's going on in these three areas, is that it's not concerned about individual animals. Okay? It's really concerned about species and systems. Right? So we really don't care which deer is there as long as there are deer. Okay? We don't really care which songbird is there, which meadowlark is there, as long as there are meadowlarks. Okay. And we don't really care which particular chipmunk is there, as long as there are chipmunks, although perhaps these that we have buffets to hold them, we wish there weren't. Because usually we lose some of our dinner to those. So these concentrate not so much on the individual animal, but on the species. Okay. The interesting thing, however, is that these three approaches can be in conflict with each other. Okay, these aren't consistent. And some of you may be able to think of ways in which they have come in conflict in your areas. I don't know. Can anybody think of ways in which these have come in conflict where you are? Or that you've read about?
Conflict in one neighborhood. Doesn't want to get 525 Carl Bags black oil sunflower seeds to feed the chipmunks, because she thinks it's going to fall from behind and eat her cement fire going to cause it to raise up. I can't see that it makes any difference to her at all. They still have the seeds and they still get the milk. The only bothers me is that I don't have a baffle to go on top of a bird feeder, and a squirrel is up in the tree and there's a wicket down the pole. And he and the raccoon at night will reach over, it's supposed to be squirrel food. He reaches over those and he pushes down there, but why not with his body that the seeds will come out and smarter than that?
My parents had a terrible time bear-proofing their bird feeder in New Hampshire.
Really?
Yeah. There are a couple of bear in the neighborhood who have very sleek, shiny coats because of all the wonderful high-protein bird feed that they're always getting. There's a battle between the people in the neighborhood and the bears trying to figure out ways to build bird feeders that will be both squirrel-proof and bear-proof, but still accessible to the birds. Pretty soon, they failed so far. New Hampshire? Okay, they failed so far.
Well, I think deer is an example. You know, people want the deer around, but they don't want them eating the plants. They don't want them shot or killed when there's an overpopulation.
Right.
And so then the deer end up starving to death because they've got to have food and they've got to live. And if there's too many, then that's the other alternative for them, is to starve.
Right, which seems unkind as well, right?
Right.
Right. You're right where Fermi Lab is, not far from where we live, actually. They've had an overpopulation of deer. There was a big battle last fall. They were merging, what do they call it? Culling the herd or something?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's going to go on again this fall or not, but there's a river of people around there.
I forgot about that one. You're right. That's close.
You know, and around here too is that I was reading about and talking to Captain Lily late about the cougar population exploding because of the law that was passed that you can't hunt with dogs. And he was saying things that's a really bad law because there's so many cougars now. And then we went away and we didn't see mountain goats, but is that because, you know, cougars are increasing in population? And we just talked about that on the Golden Way out.
Right. Mm-hmm. So very often we decide there's some species we really like to look at and we want to preserve it. And it ends up eating up some other species, right? Or Aldo Leopold, I'm not going to get the line right, but there's a line in Aldo Leopold that said, you know, basically, if you were a mountain, you really would be afraid of deer because they would eat up all of the... prevents erosion, right? And so as a mountain, you see a deer coming, you go, oh no, right? So what we do in order to preserve some cute, cuddly creature ends up unbalancing an ecosystem and causing problems in biodiversity because you end up either expanding or reducing some other population. So we end up then preserving, trying to manage species, right? In order to keep them in some kind of ecosystematic balance. But whenever we get aesthetics involved, we end up harming these two pieces of the pie, usually. Okay. There are also a couple of ways of looking at animals. If we're going to think of animals as beings that we need to respect, what kinds of principles, reasons, what kinds of beings are they, animals? If we need to respect them within limits of biodiversity and ecosystematic preservation and thoughtless cruelty, right? Who are they? So, what kind of argument do we make for them? Are they like people? What is it that makes them worthy of our attention besides the fact that they're useful and they keep our ecosystem going? Is that it, or is there something else? What is a good enough reason to respect an animal? Right, creation, right. And that's one of the most important pieces to it because some principles we came up with the other day include those, okay? So they're part of God's good creation. So we respect them as fellow creatures, right? Other pieces to that?
You can make the lion lie down with the lamb, so maybe we just do a few there.
Okay, so what you said is that they have a role in creation but also a role in redemption, right, in the restored world, right? So that they are partners with us in this process of creation and redemption somehow, right? And so they fit into God's plan, and so therefore in a way of honoring God and God's plan of creation and redemption, we need to honor animals.
Okay. Anything and how else? Do we know that except for that one quote from Isaiah, which you said had more than one interpretation?
That has more than one interpretation. There are also...
How do we know that animals are a part of the redeemed, the world to come? How do we know that?
Well,
they were saved on the ark.
That's true. They are saved on the ark.
That's a good one.
Although they're useful to us, too. There are a few other things. It's not clear not all of the Bible suggests to us that the physical world is redeemed. Mm-hmm. So there's that tension too, because some of the physical world, in some places, the physical world ends up looking pretty dispensable. I'm about to get rid of a puma here. I'm sorry, I missed that example.
Dispensable.
Okay, but there are some places in which it's suggested that God cares for animals, or that our effects, that ill effects on the world or ill effects on animals have something to do with our action, and that God disapproves of those. For instance, in many places in the prophets, it turns out that there are hints that environmental destruction isn't created by God to punish human beings. It's that human beings, by having wars and doing other things that disrespect the landscape, have caused there to be fewer plants and animals for themselves to eat, right? So the desolation that comes is not God sort of destroying the plants and animals, but human beings doing so. So there are hints all through, but that's where we get back to the complaint that eco-theologians have. There's nowhere in the Bible that really does explain how we're supposed to think of plants and animals, and so we have to take all these little hints and try to put them in together into something, okay? So they're part of a good creation. They're part of the order of redemption, or at least we want to think about that possibility hard, right? Okay. Also, this also suggests that there's a continuity and interdependence, right? This idea that they're part of a good creation. We can't, I said this the other day in the class, but I think it's really true here. There's no such thing as a post-agricultural society, right? We will always be dependent on plants and animals for our livelihood and for eating, okay? So this is also something that hints that we are to be respectful in some way of them. There's also the sense in Genesis 1, anyway, that we have a responsibility to participate in God's plan. We can think, we have therefore been given the responsibility to see what's going on and react to it in some organized way. So if we notice that there's an overpopulation of deer out near Fermilab, we might think twice about putting wolves on the property since it's a suburban area, but we probably should think about how to manage the deer, right? And there are limits within which we have to do that. So there's some kind of responsibility.
And, I lived out in the country, and there were a lot of deer out there. And, you know, as the population grew, we started to get more and more coyotes. Mm-hmm. So that balance was going to start to take care of itself with the coyotes, to take down probably some of those deer.
But when you artificially isolate the deer from their natural predators, it won't happen.
Right.
So the main point to all of this, of course, is that there are particular laws according to which the ecosystem operates, and it will keep operating according to those laws even when you change some piece of it.
And it sort of wants to adjust itself, but then we'll start interfering with coyotes, so we'll have the same problem. But if we left it alone, it would kind of help to support itself a little bit.
Right. I mean, equilibration will happen in some way. Either the deer will eat up all the plants and then die, or we'll send in the coyotes, or we'll kill the deer, right? But that kind of equilibration is going to happen. The question is how to do it and which way is more respectful and constructive. Because our welfare is at some point in conflict with the welfare of some other animal. As you said with your example, we need to kill the elk to eat. Right. Okay. One of the most important frames of reference for thinking about this whole question is that when people come to a place like Holden, they very often say, "Feels so good to be out here in nature," implying that when they're at home, they're not
in nature,
right? But we are, right? Nature is including us, Nature is creation. It's not us and nature. And one of the great ironies of Holden, of course, is the tailings. Because you cannot pretend that you're entirely in nature, right? It's a great reminder. I'm not saying I hope they never go away or get contained or something, but it reminds us, really, that we are all part of the same system. And so animals are not in some other realm. We are all together. We can't have this dichotomy. So these are some principles that help us organize our thinking. So what do? In situations in which the welfare of a particular animal or population of animals seems to be antithetical to ours. And it could be a very valuable population of animals. Okay? What do we do when a population of animals, their welfare, is somewhat in conflict with ours? What do we do? One example is the deer who eat our lettuce. Okay. That's a trivial example.
The coyotes that kill our cats. I do that one all the time.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes the sheep, or the wolves they released in Idaho that are, you know, have killed a lot of sheep and the lambs and a lot of the calves.
Mm-hmm. Right. Because those are the capital of farmers,
right?
That's their investment.
Right.
They're going to raise them, and so in some senses, it's more harmful.
A lot of times that happens because the natural food that they would have has been taken away or lost.
Maybe.
So then they come down because of hungry and kill that. But normally they wouldn't come down to eat that. Don't domesticated, you know, animals that are down there. They come down when they don't have the food.
But then if they eat enough of it, they become dependent on it, right?
All a bear has to do is raid a garbage can one time to figure out that it's a heck of a lot easier to eat people food than it is to pick those huckleberries one at a time.
That's right. Any of you who pick thimbleberries and blueberries and hold them on a trail, but a bear would have to spend an awful long time eating those to get them.
See, I have a real problem with people that feed wild animals.
You want me to feed my chickens? Sure.
No.
Oh, dear.
We had a bunny in our yard that lived under the tree. I never fed it, and it was very friendly. Our neighbor shot it, but it was very friendly. It used to sit by me when I weeded and everything, but I never fed it because I felt, you know, it really should have its natural habitat, its natural way of eating, you know, because now if it was starving, I might have relented and fed it, but... You know, in essence, though, you know, I think wild animals should have the food that they were intended to have.
That's kind of what I was wondering about. With the, I understand that there is no nature separate from humanity, and yet at the same time, part of, but at least maybe it's my lens, but like Psalm 104 or Jesus teaching about. Consider the lilies of the field. There's a biblical awe, a sense of awe, human awe for the wild creation that it's not dependent on us. And as I think about animals, when we come into conflict with animals, to me that's always a consideration. Is for there to be. It's appropriate for animals to be able to still be wild, and what that might mean about how we dispose of our garbage, or even how I protect my little 3.5-year-old out here from the cougars, that we have to adapt so that they can remain wild, and that wildness is, in some ways, a lens for us to see. I mean, St. Francis thought that the diversity of wildness was a way to image God, which is all through the Bible.
Right, and which is another wonderful image. And this points, by the way, to the importance for having images for these things, not just technical descriptions, because images get you farther. The one thing we need to be aware of, though, is if this is the world of the biblical world, especially the Hebrew Bible, and this is our world, here is the domestic part of the world, and here is the world part. It takes a lot more courage to appreciate the wild than when it's kind of this way, which is what we've got now. There was really no need to respect and preserve the wildness of the wild here, because your concern was that the wildness of the wild was going to eat you up, right? And what we're concerned about now is that the wildness of our domesticity will eat up the wild, right? And so part of this is going to be a bit tetchy of me, I guess. I think part of the reason we want to preserve our national forests and our national parks is we want to feel a little bit less guilty. We want to say, but we left some, right? So this is, it takes a lot of courage to appreciate the wild here. It only takes sentimentality to begin to appreciate the wild here. So when we read biblical passages about wildness, we need to remember the difference in the horizons. I think we're at the end of our time, and I shouldn't go beyond. What I do want to leave you with one question. Eco-theologians, some of them deal with animals by saying, sort of extending our being to them. Mm-hmm. Animals are beings like us. So let's think of them that way. Other eco-theologians, and Daniel Cowden, and he's wonderful on this, he's one of these very balanced thinkers that refuses to go off in any extreme directions and really is appreciative of everyone else's efforts. So he's great to read.
Daniel
Cowden. Cowden, C-O-W-D-I-N. Says, what if we look at it really the other way? What about thinking of ourselves as creatures of God? Animals are creatures of God. We are humankind. They are other kinds. We don't have to have only one kind of beings. Okay? So it's not that we're being disrespectful of animals if we think of them as something other than human beings with souls and hearts and minds and little sentiments. We don't do them a disservice. What we need to do is figure out what kinds of beings they are and respect them as that. Respectful, I think your point is great. But realizing that they're not just like us and that their purpose on earth is not just like ours. They are part of this creation, but they're not just like us. Okay, I'm going to end there because it's nearly time for first dinner. And thank you all for spending part of this beautiful sunny afternoon under fluorescent lights.
What do you think of four things? What's the purpose?